When it comes to investing, retirement, taxes, healthcare, and estate planning, the decisions you make today can greatly affect the quality of life for you and your loved ones tomorrow. What you need is straight and unbiased information on the most important issues you'll face when planning for your retirement and financial future. Good news! You found Premier Retirement Radio with Jeff Fogan. Jeff is the founder of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management, and he's been guiding people financially and into retirement for 30 years. So get ready for an hour of the most comprehensive financial information on the radio, Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan. And now here's Jeff Fogan and Jeff Shade.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan, the radio show that gives you the straight talk and honest answers you need to help you reach your wealth management and retirement goals through smart investing and careful planning. My name is Jeff Shade, and I'm here to ask the questions, of course, but you know the words of wisdom and solid advice. Well, they come from Jeff Fogan, founder and president of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Hey, Jeff, how you doing this weekend?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Glad to be with you and glad to be with all the fine people here, the greater Tucson area, talking about finances and getting to and through retirement, getting retired and staying retired. We have got a lot of things to talk about on the show today. Once again, I'm going to let people know right off the bat, Jeff, what our telephone number is. It's 520-780-9059. If you've got questions or comments about anything that you hear in the show today, don't hesitate to use that number, 520-780-9059. You can also use that number to request your complimentary retirement blueprint, a conversation with Jeff, 520-780-9059. Okay, Jeff, I was looking at a very interesting article here that said, for a record 450 days, this recession indicator pointed to a downturn that never arrived. Now, I would imagine that the indicator would be the inverse yield curve. What else are we talking about here?
Well, there's a lot of indicators. There's also the, you've got the leading economic indicator index, which was down at least 22 months in a row. I don't remember if I saw the last month, but the leading economic indicators, that's a group of 10 different economic indicators, everything from building starts, which we know are actually suffering right now. We've got some latest data that the home builders, Home Depot, Lowe's, home builders, ETFs are losing value rapidly. We've got energy peaking out. We've got a lot of different sectors that are, kind of showing top heavy. But if you look at the economy, it's not really been that good since Biden's been in office. I don't know if you realize it, but Bidenomics is really a joke. It just blows my mind that he would put his name on it, to be honest with you. But I guess if they tell you it's good and there's enough people that believe everything they hear on TV, you're out of the president's mouth because, presidents never lie.
I had to laugh at that one.
Yeah. Then obviously the Bidenomics is making the world a better place and we're all able to afford our food and gas and, things really aren't costing as much. And
right.
The 8.7 million people that have second jobs, much of which have been touted as new jobs created or their second jobs people have to take just to make ends meet. Government jobs, low paying jobs, green cards and work permits for illegal aliens. Those are all, the economic boom we're talking about. But, there's been a lot of cycles that have been tracked anywhere from, 50 to 60 years to back to the Great Depression to even beyond that from a look back period. And there's, different things that have always ended in recession. You've got the inverted yield curve, which I think is 7 or 8 times now. It's got 100% fulfillment ratio. When the yield curve gets upside down, when long-term bond yields are less than short-term bond yields, and right now long-term bonds are, in the 3.5-4 range max anywhere over 20 years. And you've got a short-term range between 5 and 5.5, short-term bonds, 3 months. They'll give you 5.5% on your money annualized for 3 months. But only give you 3.5 if you want a 30-year T-bond. So that's kind of a disconnect in the standpoint of, risk-reward, just common norms that have happened for 100-plus years. Every time the yield curve inverts, it usually means that there's, economic turmoil. And it always has ended within 2-year period of time. Somewhere between 11 and 14 months is kind of the median time frame that it typically happens. But they've been as long as, I believe it's been 2 years or close to that for the longest one. And while, the government has learned and the central bank and Wall Street has learned to kind of get in cahoots together and kind of manipulate things, maybe these cycles will take a little bit longer, but the cycles have always completed, that one included. And so that might have been the one that you're indicating, just as this economic indicator. There's also the yield curve. There's also the private households owning stock is over 60%. That's only happened a couple of times in history. And that is when, so many people are excited about the stock market. And private household is really considered the dumb money because they don't have access to the inside information on Wall Street that insiders have. That's why they call it insider trading. And by the way, insider trading is people like CEOs, you know, Jeff Bezos, who sold close to $8 billion of his own stock recently. Why would he do that unless he thought it was either overvalued or a great time to sell? You know, he's got insider information, inside information. He's an insider. He has to declare those sales, but nevertheless, he sold. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, Meta sold a bunch of stock. Apple CEO, and, you know, sold 100 million plus. We've got Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan, sold recently. These are insiders that know more about when to hold them and when to fold them type things. And we're seeing more insider trading right now than we've ever seen, which also indicates, you know, weak economy, weak market, weak futures. Economic indicators, as I mentioned, still heading down. You know, they talk about manufacturing being some sort of a manufacturing revolution. Well, last year, every sector in the country was down, not up in manufacturing. There might be a slight rebound now that we're seeing. A few things are, you know, picking up to where maybe some of the demand for, you know, isn't being met on our foreign manufacturers, and we're reviving a little bit of manufacturing here. But overall, a lot of manufacturing going out of business. A lot of those jobs that are being cut are manufacturing, high-paying manufacturing jobs. And then we're replacing them with these low-paying government subsidized or government jobs or low-paying jobs that really don't make up the difference. And you've got inflation, which is another indicator that ends in recession. Almost all the time we've had inflation persistent, staying up, kind of like it did if you want to compare it to a time back in Jimmy Carter eras where we had stagflation, where the market, you know, kind of stunk for, you know, 15 years or so. Back then, however, prior to Obama taking presidency, there was a thing called the free market system where things were based on, you know, what the value of a stock was, what somebody was actually willing to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. Since Obama's come into, you know, when he first came into office, there was that big economic crisis. The banking crisis was happening right at the end of George Bush's presidency. And then market crashed. And then, of course, Obama saved the day by saying, hey, you know what? Let's do what other third world countries do. They just print money and they don't really care about what it does to inflation or supply demand curve or to the economy overall. But it might make everything look hunky-dory fine. So let's just print money. Let's do, you know, modern monetary theory, which has now become the buzzword for printing money. You know, at the time, I believe it was $8 trillion in debt. It was four when Bush took office. It was eight when he left office. And now there's over four times that, $33, $34 trillion in debt, which is equivalent to just printing that much money. How do you print that much money and not get inflation? Well, the only way you can do that is that you keep up with supply at such a level that it creates, you know, price pressures downward to accommodate all the demand. And that has happened until COVID. And then all of a sudden, when there was a little bit blip in the supply chain, bam, all of a sudden now we see what the printed money does. And it just gives people with it the power to overpay for everything or to drive prices up. So the haves get it, the have-nots hurt and have to work harder to get it. So we've still got some economic issues that, you know, are going on about a decade and a half long, where the stock market doesn't necessarily reflect, I guess, the cycles of the past, maybe, or does it? You know, the thing is cycles seem to always complete, but with the manipulation, maybe the can gets kicked down the road a little longer. I still am in the camp that the cycle that started in 2018, which is 10 years after the 08 crash, and typically there's, you know, a doozy every 10 years or so, or less. Actually, it's about every seven, I think. But anyway, every decade typically sees a nice correction. We started having it in 2018, but the Fed intervened by printing more money. Another QE bailed them out. Basically, they pumped the banks full of cash. They were able to kind of solve the problem and get their feet back and throw all that money into the stock market and make it look like the economy was doing well. See, it seems like the last 10 or 15 years, we are now equating the economy with the stock market. And honestly, they're not related. In fact, sometimes the market can do better when the economy is doing worse, like it seems to be doing now. The economy isn't that robust if you're a middle-class person trying to buy food and gas and live the same lifestyle they lived a few years ago. Nevertheless, the market's going great. So the people with a lot of money are doing great because if it's in the stock market, they're doubling, tripling their money every few years. It's unfortunately a separation of the classes is what's happening. But back to your question, why hasn't this recession happened? Well, mm-hmm. it's continued manipulation and they're learning how to do it better and better. I'll just give an example of the last few days, just in the last few weeks. You know, we had this Israel scare, you know, supposedly, which was given credit for, you know, Iran shooting missiles toward Israel, was given credit for the market crashing a couple of Fridays ago. And in reality, that morning and the morning prior, we had horrible earnings come out with banks. We had, you know, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo underperformed. We had, you know, Visa not looking good. We had Citicorp say that they made a little bit of money, but most of that was just on the exorbitant amount of credit cards card fees they were charging because everybody's using credit cards to buy food, gas, and everything else, and they're not paying down their loans, so they're making credit card interest, but they're not making, none of the banks are really making interest on, you know, lending money and doing things that build the economy. So that kind of threw the market for a loop. And then, that following Monday, about a week ago, we had all of a sudden the futures are up. Oh, market futures are up. The worry about the Middle East are gone. And I'm thinking, why did they even make it about that? It wasn't about the Middle East. It was about crappy earnings. You know, we've had, you know, increasing statistics that say inflation is not under control. Inflation's still growing at about 4 or 5% a year if you analyze the month-to-month numbers. Even though, you know, if you catch it on a month that it was a little high last year and it's a little higher this year, from a year-to-year basis, from a month-to-month, from the peak to peak, might only be 2.8%. But if you look at it on a realistic what it's doing now basis and times that by 12 months, you know, we're still growing at a 3 to 5% easy inflation rate, which is, you know, pretty much eating up the short-term rate of return on bonds and things like that. Typically, we like it to be a little bit better, that the return on your investment should be better than the inflation rate, right? That's kind of the hope. Bottom line is inflation's out of control. Jobs numbers are fake. They keep getting revised down. And then we got all this manipulation with, the Fed, Wall Street, central bank basically saying, you know what, we can manipulate the market. Let's blame it on something other than the fact that that companies aren't making money and inflation's out of control and that we really aren't seeing robust growth compared to the growth in the stock market prices of the S&P 500, Dow, or any index that you look at. So what they do is the central bank can actually buy futures. So can the market maker. So can, you know, the banks can actually buy futures to make it appear that the market has shrugged off these negative earnings reports or shrugged off the idea that, Iran could still, you know, pop missiles into Israel or create some sort of damage. I think that was just a test, by the way. I think Iran knew nothing was going to get through, but I think they wanted to test the resolve of the U.S. on how much we wanted to support Israel. They wanted to test Israel to see if their defense system really worked. And that was all just kind of a side note. It did not have, in my opinion, anything to do with the stock market or the cycles that you're talking about. It had to do with just a geopolitical event, which, by the way, can come in and affect the market in a very big way as well. Should it continue to escalate and get worse, I think it will put a damper on the market. But here's what I see as really being the problem is interest rates are still high because inflation is still high. People are still able to buy less. The Fed really cannot lower interest rates, even though supposedly 3-4 months ago, they're saying we're going to lower them at least 3 times. And the banks and the brokerage firms were all saying, 5 to 7 times. And so they've got all that priced in. They've already priced in the fact that this year we're going to have 3 to 5 interest rate reductions, which now people are saying, probably not any. Or if we do, maybe 1 or 2 at the end of the year. But it's already been priced in. You know, what happens when people realize, well, we've already kind of priced in some rate decreases. We've also priced in the fact that companies are going to make about 25% more profit or more earnings are going to go up about 20 to 30% this year instead of 0 to 1% like they did last year. And if we look at the earnings expectations just in this current quarter, the first quarter of this year, and we look at it from a year ago basis, a year to year basis, they're expecting it to come in around 5% annualized growth rate on earnings. Well, how in the world is the stock market up 35% since its bottom last year, or 25, depending on, you know, what day you look at it? It's been gyrating and a lot of volatility lately, but it's up an incredible amount exponentially compared to what it ought to be, compared to the actual earnings growth. And, you know, companies getting their feet back on the ground really isn't happening. We're seeing tens of thousands of people being laid off. Tesla now is laying off, high paid jobs. Where are those people going to go? Bottom line is, to answer your question, why hasn't this recession happened yet? There's been a lot of manipulation in the market. There's a lot of money that's gone in that kind of has to find its parking spot that isn't as fluid. And I think when the reality sets in that the economy is not really in as good a place and, you know, there are no gains and there are no interest rate cuts and things do escalate in the Middle East, it'll be a great excuse for a sell-off, which may cause that recession that always ends historically within about 2 years of the yield curve inversion. So I still think we have plenty of time. I think, what did you say, is like 460 days into the day it started? Well, 2 years is 730 days in my math, right? 365 times two. So, and we had a leap year, so it's 331 now. You know, we still have time to have that cycle repeat and complete. And the only reason it didn't complete last year when the market was down in 2022 is because the Fed bailed out banks to the tune of about $3 trillion and gave it to the banks, and the banks couldn't loan the money out to build the economy or to save their, they basically stayed in business. But the way they stayed in business was buy their own stock when stock buyback programs, pumping their own stock, even though their financial health wasn't good, still isn't, by the way. They're still receiving all kinds of concessions and accommodations by the Fed and by our government not to pay off their bad debts or even give the money back that they loan them a year ago that were supposed to start getting paid back in March, haven't done that. The tech companies, they don't thrive when there's high interest rates, yet nevertheless, some of these companies are going through the moon because of the AI hype. There's just a lot of things that are lining up to where I still think the market will complete its cycle. I'm not out of that camp yet just because it hasn't happened. You know, I hear people all the time say, you know, hey, this cycle's going to happen. It's going to be a downturn. And then, you know, in a month they say, well, there hasn't been. You're wrong. Well, it doesn't mean there's not going to be. We just don't know when it is. But in the cyclical, you know, cycles of markets, we've got a lot of bubbles ready to go. The economic indicators, private ownership of stock, insider trading at all times highs. We've got just the value of the GDP growth is not anywhere close to what the price earnings ratios of stocks are. PE ratios are higher than they've been except two times. Actually, I think the second highest they've been in history, and the only times that they've been as high as they are right now. In other words, what we're willing to pay for the price of a stock, how much we're willing to overpay for a stock based on its viability of earnings, profits, growth rates, revenues, and et cetera, it hasn't been higher except in the dot bomb bubble that burst, you know, 24 years ago. The only other time it was almost as high as it is right now was the 29 crash when people were just overpaying for stocks and that bubble burst. So there's the PE ratios, inverted yield curve, private ownership of stock, economic indicators, inflation, and GDP versus stock price, the Warren Buffett indicator. There's like six right there. Oh, and the fact that the only money that's left out there that's fluid from the stimulus money is really the money that they've been backdooring giving to the banks and a little bit of the stimulus that they gave for the infrastructure bill. That's why you're seeing companies like John Deere and Caterpillar still doing well, because they've still got boatloads of money to spend as long as they're, you know, pretending to do it on infrastructure and developing things that the government says are okay. You know, they get a lot of subsidies from a lot of that infrastructure bill that's a lot of these support companies contribute to. However, housing is down. That's an economic indicator that we ought to look at, not how much money the government's given for infrastructure. So that's a lot said. That was a short question. It's a long answer as usual.
As always.
Is the show almost over? I'm sorry. Are we? I know this is kind of like my rant session.
Yeah, no. And I enjoy the rant session every week because I think people sit down and, you know, they listen to this. It's obvious that you have an opinion on this, but it's also, this is an educated opinion as well, too. So with that in mind, I'm going to let our listeners know that if you have questions for Jeff, you want to sit down with him and talk about your individual situation, you want to talk about what's going on in the economy, in the world, and how it affects your journey towards a prosperous retirement, we are offering this no-cost, no-obligation retirement roadmap with Jeff. Again, it's not going to cost you a dime. There is no obligation whatsoever. To get yours, 520-780-9059. It's very simple. Make that call this weekend, 520-780-9059. Just a friendly conversation with Jeff to get your questions answered. And once again, we're not going to try to sell you anything in this complimentary conversation whatsoever. It's just a fact-finding mission for you to put you on a path towards a confident retirement. Once again, no cost for it at all, no obligation, 520-780-9059. You can also request your retirement roadmap online at premret.com, premret.com. Jeff, it's no secret, of course, that we have an election going on this year, a rather contentious election. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this in my history on this earth. So how do you think, as every day this election ticks closer and closer, is going to affect the economy and the market, particularly with the challenges that we have, not only with both political parties, but also with what's going on in the economy and the market today?
Well, yeah, there's always that election. What happens in an election cycle? Typically, the first half of the year in an election cycle, it's flat to down. You know, we've seen mostly up at the beginning of the year, mostly because of the rumors of lowering interest rates and everybody, all the, you know, household money, the tourist, I don't know, that's a term that I heard somebody use, the tourist investors who really don't know the information. They just get on board because, hey, it looks like let's go for the ride, right? A lot of tourist investors jumping in the market because of the AI hype. You know, NVIDIA had an incredibly good couple of quarters in a row. Their year over year is, you know, huge as far as their growth rates go. However, you know, their demand is waning. Their demand is getting, you know, split between AMD, who's got some good chips out, Intel's got some good chips out. There's a lot of things that were overly hyped, I think, and overbought. So everybody bought all the tech stocks for a while and drove it up. But we haven't seen much in the last 4 to 6 weeks. We've seen kind of a flat to down market trend. And if it continues to go down, we'll give up 8 or 10% that we we got right out of the gate at the beginning of the year, going into kind of that first half of the election. Now, what I think the economic cycle typically is, and it's not quite as early known as it is right now, if you think about it, you know, we've got two people that have already been president. We already know them. We already know who the candidates are going to be. We already know who the race is about. So we're kind of at a place where we normally wouldn't be until June, July, August, about the second half of the year, but it's definitely before the second half of the year. And we already know who's playing, who the players are. Does that mean, that cycle isn't going to happen where, since it's there's not the unknown where people kind of sell off to see what might happen in the election? Right before the election, it always seems like fiscal policy from the White House, whoever's in power, doesn't want any to rock the boat. And so the fiscal policies become somewhat accommodating to the market and to, the people that want to, stay in power, obviously. And so, they don't want that to be an excuse for some new guy to say, hey, look, the market's crashing. This guy must be a stupid president. The market and the presidency, unfortunately, don't correlate, but the policies the president makes do affect the market. So, you've got to look at that and wonder what could happen between now and the election. Is it going to be a typical election cycle where we have kind of a slow to flat market early and then we have a kind of a nice, robust, steady market into the end of the year while we have the election? I think the unknown of the election is going to be so unknown that I think it's going to be flipped. I think, we kind of got away with the upside of the market early on. I think there's a good chance that the powers that be may actually allow maybe the fear of the Middle East tension and stuff to be the excuse, not Bidenomics, of course, but just the fear of Middle East tension or some sort of geopolitical event or something like that to be the catalyst to cause a market correction so that the Democrats can come in and save the day right before the election, say, see, look at Bidenomics is working. We saved it. We printed $8 trillion more dollars and, threw it at the market and look at everything's going good. Your 401ks are better, so don't vote me out or it's going to be a horrible time. The other thing that they could do is, if we don't get it right now, they could just kick that can down the road by doing these accommodating, and we call that accommodating, policies, which started, like I mentioned before, with Obama printing money, basically accommodating the stock market. In other words, the Fed and the government gets to determine what the prices of stock are nowadays a lot more than fundamentals. And it's frustrating to me because I learned fundamentals. And the fundamentals are less important now than it is just the accommodations or the policies that government and the Fed are doing. Yet, they do have a job to keep the economy, in as good a manner as they can so that we'll keep being able to pay taxes and fund their agendas, their expensive agendas, requiring higher taxes. That means they have to require somebody's got to be making money in this economy. So Bidenomics can't fail everybody. Bottom line is there's a lot of things going on between now and the election that may actually keep the market from crashing. I think Democrats would love it if Trump wins to let it crash just as soon as the election's over and just, pull the rug out from underneath everything between the election and the inauguration and then say, well, that's because everybody was fearful of Trump. Look what he did. He crashed the market, blah, blah, blah. And then it's on his watch to fix, which that does happen because Democrats, by and large, are somewhat accommodating to the markets. If you look at history, markets usually do pretty well. When a Republican gets elected, typically there's some fiscal responsibility that gets put in order. And I'm saying this based on what I've observed in history. It seems to take a little work. And sometimes we have to go through some corrections and things like that to where it doesn't look like during Republican presidencies over time that have been really the most robust times in the stock market. It's generally been the opposite, even though when Trump was in office, we did pretty well. Although we did have the 18 crisis, I guess the printing money during COVID kind of helped the markets, but it was kind of a drag on the economy, obviously, because we're still in a big mess from that. Bottom line is the election cycle may or may not have an effect on the market. And like I've said before, I don't really care. I've had a few clients say, why aren't we in the market? We're only making 5% of our stock market money. Because you could lose 20 to 50% if the bubble pops. If any of these bubbles pop that we talked about in the first 10 or 15 minutes pop and it creates that recession and money gets lost a lot faster than it gets made. I mean, the market kind of trickles up. You don't have a week or two where it goes up 10 or 15%, but you can have a week or two where it goes down 10 or 15% in the market on the downside. And it's too hard to bail fast enough when the market, turns its ugly head and goes the other way. So we don't want to have a lot of money that you may need in retirement, especially if you're retired or down that process or getting really close. You want to preserve those assets best you can. But here's how we've done it. And I just saw a guy yesterday, Friday, I guess, if you're listening on Sunday, that came in and was saying, is it time to get in the market? Isn't the market doing good? And I showed him the graphs. It's really been flat to down in the last 6 weeks. And he goes, oh yeah, okay. So what we hear on the news is just the good days, right? Well, yeah, pretty much. But we noticed that on his index annuity he bought a year ago in April, that his index annuities that go up more correlated with the market are up 16%. And there's no principal risk on that.
even though, and then his market money is up 5%. So overall, I mean, we're still keeping up better than inflation, better than CDs, overall doing just fine. Now, keep in mind, last year, the market was, you know, starting at a low point, but, you know, if we compare it to the stock market's up more than that, but the stock market could give that back and you're actually losing money on the indexed annuities that we use to take advantage of the upside of the market and even take advantage of the benevolent, accommodating policies that the White House and the Fed are giving us right now. Is, you know, helping those things that are safe more than the things that are unsafe. The thing is we don't want to put all of our money out at risk, and we can make money even on the money that isn't at risk in times if the market doesn't actually crash. But if it does, we want to be in a position where we don't lose and it doesn't blow up your retirement plan for the long haul. So we do keep all these things in mind, and we do plan accordingly. We want to win whether the market does well or the market does poorly. We don't want to, you know, it's more important not to lose than it is to, you know, maximize gains every time the market goes up.
Jeff, hate to cut you off. That's a lot of great information. Once again, for our listeners, our telephone number, 520-780-9059. If you want to sit down and talk with Jeff, 520-780-9059. Jeff, time for a break. When we come back, we've got listener questions and more when our show continues here on 790 KNST, Tucson's most stimulating talk.
You can't start a trip you've never taken without a plan. And you can't start your retirement journey without a comprehensive plan to get there safely. To request your no-cost Premier Retirement Roadmap, call 580-780-9059 or request it online at premret.com. Now back to more Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan and Jeff Shade.
Welcome back to Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan, founder and president of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management in Tucson and also up in Mesa. My name's Jeff Shade. Glad you could join us again this week. We're here for you every week for your fiscal fitness and your financial education here on 790 KNST, Tucson's most stimulating talk. And we're on several times a week for you. We're on Saturdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 1 p.m., and also Sundays at 11 a.m. If you've missed any part of our program, you can't join us during those times. Remember, we're also a podcast. Go to wherever you get great podcast and search for Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan. You'll find this show and many of our past shows so you can stay on top of your journey towards a confident retirement. Okay, Jeff, let's dive in right here. The second half of the show, we always start it with listener questions, and Jake is up next. Jake's listening to us in Tucson, and Jake writes, I'm 42, married with two kids aged 10 and 13. My household income is about $110,000. My mother just passed away recently, leaving me $2.2 million in stocks, bonds, and cash. I use $75,000 to pay off debts, including two cars. I also still have $200,000 left on my mortgage. Should I pay that off? If so, then how should I start to invest the remaining $1.9 million?
Well, that's a great question. Now, I'm sorry to hear about your mom and her passing, but the good thing about inheritances are they get a step-up basis tax-wise, unless you have some annuities and things like that, or IRA money that, you know, I don't really know the breakdown of this. If there's IRA money and things like that, you might have a different tax situation, but I don't think it's a big deal whether you pay the house off or not, unless it gives you the peace of mind that you need. There's obviously plenty of money in there to do that, but I think over the next 20 years, let's just say you're 42, you have kids, you're probably going to work another 20 years, I'm guessing. I mean, you're not going to just say, oh, I got $2 million, let's just retire. I mean, I suppose you could. You'd have to, you know, build a plan that created guaranteed income, at least to Social Security age, and you wouldn't get a whole lot of that because you're not working for the next 20 years. So I'm going to assume you're going to keep working. You've got, you know, young children that probably need to go to college in a few years if you want to do that kind of a thing, or trade school or something, learn a skill that, you know, they can be self-sufficient with. Again, it's just kind of, if you want to pay off the house, great. If you have a 2% mortgage, honestly, I think it's silly because you can make more money on your money than you can paying it off. But again, if it's a value thing where you like to have a free house and, you know, you listen to your grandpa or people old school that used to say, pay off your mortgage. Well, that was probably when mortgages were 7 or 8 or 10% in interest. And if that's the case, I think if you have anything higher than about a 4 or 5% mortgage, you ought to just pay it off. It's easy just not to have that payment. And then all your cash flow is all your cash flow to spend. You don't have to be saddled to a mortgage other than the taxes and insurance and any improvements you have to make along the way, obviously. So how should you invest it? Well, I don't know. I'd consider a few different things. Let's say half of it's IRA and half of it's not. Let's say you've got, and I'm just going to round the numbers to a million. So let's say you have $1 million in IRA money. And in my opinion, if it's an inherited IRA or something like that, you've got 10 years to pull that money out and pay taxes on it. So you can think of it two ways. You can kind of wait till the next correction and try to cash in when the market's low and do some tax loss planning that way, or you could take it out over $100,000 a year for the next 10 years and just, you know, see how that goes. You could even annuitize it to where you get a guaranteed rate of return and a guaranteed interest, a guaranteed payment, and you would know exactly what your taxable income is going to be. So there's ways to control that if there's that 10-year payout, you know, forced on you with IRA money. Let's just say the other $1 million is money that you could put in stocks, bonds, and cash or some cash equivalents. Well, the ones that generate interest or mutual funds that generate 1099s every year are going to give you kind of a surprise tax bill every year. So I like tax efficient planning for my non-IRA money. In fact, I would have you consider that for the money that you're going to have paid taxes on if there are some, you know, IRA type funds from your mom. Once you've paid taxes on the money, it really stinks to have to keep paying taxes over and over again on the gains and stuff. I really like tax efficient products, especially while you're working, probably in a reasonably good income, at a good income level, probably in, I don't know, 22 or 24 bracket now, I'm guessing. Yeah, you don't want to go into a 30 tax bracket if you don't have to. So you have to consider what you're going to have to take out over the next 10 years tax-wise, and what you're going to make, whether it's a known increase or a surprise increase based on the type of investments that you make, based on any trades that you might make. So I would consider that whatever you do to try to look at it from a tax perspective and make sure that you can stay in the lowest tax bracket possible while you divest some of that investments that you're in your mom's estate that she's left you that you're going to need. So I would look to LIRPs, life insurance retirement plans. Here's a couple of reasons that that works great for a person your age is, you know, 10 years down the road. Let's say you took $100,000 plus gains. Let's say it was $120,000 a year for the next 10 years out of half of that money. And you put it into a LIRP. First of all, that LIRP would end up generating $200,000 or $300,000 a year tax-free cash flow to you when you decided to finally retire. So that would be nice to retire with tax-free money and only have to pay tax on your Social Security, or maybe not pay tax at all and live like a king. The other thing it gives you is a place that you can borrow without going into a higher tax bracket. You can actually borrow from a death benefit, which is tax-free, to send your kids to college, for example. You get a double tax break that way. And what I mean by that is, you know, let's say you got $1 million in this LIRP, or you say you got $1.2 million, but it's worth $1.5 million. And so if from a traditional investment, if you took $100,000 out to send one of your kids to, you know, a nice college, I'm sure it's going to cost at least that by the time they get there. You end up having to pay tax on the gains. Well, not with a LIRP. With a LIRP, you can actually borrow the $100,000. You can write checks to bookstore tuition, or, you know, the stuff that you pay direct could possibly be a tax write-off. So you actually get a write-off against the income that you make from working, yet you don't have to pay tax on the money you take out of the LIRP because you've already either paid taxes on it, or your mom did because you inherited it, got a step up in basis, and now you put it in this tax-free, basically a self-directed bank. It's kind of like having your own tax-free bank. That's, I guess, the best way to describe a LIRP. Life insurance retirement plans, you use life insurance because it creates a tax-free death benefit, but you use the tax code in order to never pay tax on the money you use from it. When you die, the rest of whatever's in that account ends up passing to your heirs tax-free. You know, you may have some tax problems or tax liability with what you just inherited from your mom, but what if you could give your kids an equal amount or more, and it would all be tax-free, and there would be no, you know, restrictions on how fast they have to pull it out, how much taxes they have to pay on it, et cetera, et cetera. No deferred taxes. This is already taxed money. So once you set it up in a LIRP, it's your flexible bank account that you can use as you want to. You can use as much or as little as you want to, and whatever's left in there when you pass away goes to your heirs, to your spouse or your heirs, if it would be on your life. So anyway, that's where I would start, is look at your tax-efficient distribution and redeploying those assets into some tax-efficient retirement planning assets. And again, if you also have another $1 million that you want in growth assets, I would use ETFs, exchange-traded funds, if you wanted to do more of a diversified sector type investment option that would not create a tax burden every year. That would only create a tax burden when you sell those assets. You would only pay at that point capital gains tax on the gains at that time. So there are ways to get the growth that you want. There are ways to get the safety that you may want, and some tax breaks along the way as well.
Jake, thank you so much for listening to us in Tucson. We appreciate you sending us this question. And of course, you'll be getting Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. Jeff, our next question comes from Randy in Oro Valley. And Randy says, I'm 67, have about $1.7 million in various assets, excluding my home, which is paid for. I'm in the market for a new financial advisor. I've interviewed 3 so far and am finding that some advisors use an outside firm to manage their money for them. How important is it for an advisor to manage money in-house, or does it even make a difference?
Well, it may make a difference. It may not make a difference. Here's what I've found in this industry, and I really like what I do as far as the interaction that I have with my clients. I sit in meetings most of the day. I really like it. It's like the premier family. It really is. And I enjoy meeting with clients. I don't have time, although I do day trade and play around on the side and I do my own little things. And sometimes I'm so busy in meetings that I miss stuff, but I don't do that for clients. So let's just say you could either be really good at trading and managing money in-house, or you could be really good at building plans and helping people save taxes and feel confident that they're not going to run out of money, and using the right asset mixes between annuities, LERPs, index products, tax-efficient products, ETFs, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, whatever it is, and create some sort of an income plan for it. That's kind of where I thrive and I really like to do. So honestly, I don't really like the pressure that I have of watching stocks and sitting glued to the ticker tape all day to make sure we're in and out of the right type of asset. So sometimes there's in-house management. And I would say that if it is done in-house, it's probably passive anyway. It's just, oh, well, we're just going to stick it in the S&P or the Qs and, you know, see what happens. And, you know, this is our risk money, so let's just not even worry about it. But then there's other asset managers that do watch it every day, that they do make trades when a stock becomes out of favor, or they find out comes with bad earnings and a bad outlook. I mean, Tesla's one that has been in favor in the past and it's not really in favor right now. You know, if we had a lot of assets and we didn't look at them very often or trade them on a regular basis, maybe we'd be in that type of a stock too long. And I'm just naming some things. I'm not saying sell Tesla short or that it's a crappy stock. It's a good company. But I mean, it's kind of finding its way right now. So there are managers that we can split our fees with where they do the heavy lifting from the standpoint of all the nerdy stuff like the quant analysis. And I think it's an asset to have good managers that are really focused on that. Now, they probably couldn't talk to you in a level that you could maybe understand what they're doing because their minds work a different way. I think I have the ability to kind of explain in layman's terms, you know, how these things work and why we do certain things. But, you know, to try to explain to you, you know, the different coefficients and ratios and, you know, quantitative analysis terminology is some of these guys that are really focused on building portfolios and managing money in an effective way, or using hedges and things that sometimes have to be, you know, looked at and maneuvered on a day-to-day basis. You know, unless I was to hire them in-house, which would be at a probably at a price that would cause my fees to have to be higher than they otherwise are, it's easier for me to go to somebody with economies of scale that's already managing $1 billion for several small offices like me, pool our business and let them do that kind of work. So I would venture to guess that the in-house managers, although it might sound really cool, my guy does this, may not be as attentive if they're visiting with clients and having other duties, or if they just like to golf with a client once in a while, that they're not going to have that hands-on focus that you might want. So I don't think there's a problem with using outside managers. We do. There's also some things that you can get through outside managers that you can't get on your own. I cannot build, because I'm a small regional firm. I mean, I'm large compared to many of the independent offices, but I mean, I'm not Merrill Lynch. You know, I can't pool $1 billion with my clients and start a private equity fund, but I can access with tens of millions of dollars of my client, of certain clients' money that's more appropriate for, and build a pool and join with other independent offices. And we can create a portfolio where we can actually access a private equity manager where they make, short-term loans and real estate investments, things that you really can't do on Wall Street. Or it doesn't have anything to do with stocks and bonds, but those can be in many ways a lot more stable. Rich people, billionaires use these hedge funds and private equity managers all the time. But most of our clients are, you know, have a few million here and there, but, you know, are not billionaires to where they have their own personal hedge fund manager, you know, in-house. So we do have access to outside investments that, you know, a lot of these firms may or may not have, but I wouldn't say that that would be a deal killer either way. I think you just need to find out what you want. If you want somebody in-house that you can say, hey, why did you buy Tesla, or why did you sell Amazon, or, you know, why are my stocks this way and why have we held on to these things? And they can answer for you because you really want to be involved in those investment decisions, then choose somebody that does it in-house. But if you want a comprehensive plan that has certain assets that, you know, are managed to try to hedge against the downside and risk, I mean, for example, if the market goes down 20 and you only lose 10, but the market goes up 30 and you make 20 of it, and yet in the overall scheme of things, it ends up in the same place 10 years from now on, would you like an outside manager that used some hedging techniques that could do that for you so that the downs aren't quite as gut achy, but the ups are still reasonable enough to make you happy in the long term? You know, those are some of the choices that you have to make. And, you know, you might have an independent agent that's really good at that. I don't know very many, at least in this town, to be honest with you. Most people do use outside firms or some sort of an asset allocation strategy that is really more passive, or at least given if it is active management, it's handed off.
Randy, hope Jeff's answer helps you make that choice. And we appreciate you listening to us in the Valley of the Gold, Oro Valley. Next question, Jeff, is Grant listening to us in Rita Ranch. And he says,
I have a Social Security claiming question. My wife and I are healthy 58-year-olds who plan to retire at age 60 and not work in retirement. Our new planner says we should take our Social Security at 62 and keep our 457 plans invested 60-40 for another 15 years, taking RMDs at 72. His thinking is that we can't get the Social Security money back. It goes away after we die, and the benefits will likely be reduced, taxed, or stopped. What do you think of this? I've also heard that we should wait as long as possible to claim, as long as we can afford it.
Well, I used to be kind of, my old school idea was wait as long as you can and take it when there's more. I'm a little bit more skeptical of that, just based on the health or the lack thereof of the Social Security Trust Fund. And just knowing that, you know, every option on the table is to raise taxes or to decrease benefits to those people who have stuff, who have been responsible, in favor of those who have not. So I think there might be a shift in what you get from Social Security. So I am with this guy you're talking to as far as taking Social Security early. However, it depends. I mean, if all you have is a 457 plan and, you know, Social Security, and that's going to make ends meet, I don't know how much you have in there. You have a couple million dollars in there. Is it $400,000 or $500,000? You have a pension from some other job. 457s are typically with first responders, so maybe you're a fireman or a policeman or government worker. I mean, if so, thank you for your service, and you know, hope you have that type of a plan. But you also have deferred comp, which is deferred compensation in the 457, which means you withheld some of your income so that you could have a nice little retirement plan in the future. You can roll a deferred comp. Once you retire, you can roll a deferred comp 457 plan to other IRAs. Now, I hope this advisor only started there. I mean, it doesn't sound like a very comprehensive plan. Our new planner says we should take. Well, I don't know if that planner, people call themselves planners. All they do is say, oh, 60-40 stocks and bonds and just park it there and wait 15 years. And then they charge you a fee for that. That doesn't sound like a plan to me. I think in addition to that, you need to look at your tax plan and find out while you're taking Social Security early at age 62, and you bridge that gap with some of your savings, obviously, between 60 and 62. But are you also in a low enough tax bracket where it would make sense to do some Roth conversions or even divest that 457 over the next 5 to 7 years and put it into a LRP so that instead of having to take the required minimum distributions when you're 73 or, you know, in this case at your age, it's going to be 75, I think, by then. 2033, I believe it is going to be age 75. So you don't have to take that money out for a long time, but if you can live on Social Security and not take any out, great. But if you have a pension that's going to start, you know, at age 60, great. Maybe you make ends meet. But what I would do is I would maximize whatever tax bracket you're in, keep paying tax at whatever the tax bracket you're in, take as much of that IRA or 457 money out. I'd convert it to an IRA. That way you're in control either to a Roth or to do LRPs with that. That would create a situation where you don't have to take the money out when you're 73. You can continue to live on, you know, the income you're used to living on, take money out on a tax-free basis every time you need an extra chunk of money, like to buy a car, go on a trip or do whatever, or help a kid through college or, you know, give it to a grandkid for graduation, whatever. But I think the tax plan here, you know, wasn't addressed. It needs to be, the income plan needs to be addressed. And I think redirecting that 457 into a better mix, a more comprehensive tax-efficient plan would make more sense. So if you're not talking comprehensive, come on in and we'll talk comprehensive with you and maybe make your good plan a really good plan.
All right, Grant, thanks so much for listening to us in Oro Valley. We do appreciate that question. And of course, we'll send you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. If you've got a question you'd like us to answer on the air, you can get it to us a couple different ways. One of which is you can call it in to Shelly. She'll take it down 520-780-9059, 520-780-9059, or better yet, I think the best way to get it to us is to go out to our website, which is premret.com, P-R-E-M-R-E-T.com. Use the contact page there, send it to us, and again, if we use it on the air, we'll send you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. You're listening to Premier Retirement with Jeff Ogan. Once again, use that telephone number that I've just said to you in order to get your no-cost, no-obligation retirement roadmap, 520-780-9059. Again, it is just a casual conversation with Jeff to get your questions answered. Again, not going to sell you anything in this consultation. It's sort of like a public service. It's a chance to sit down one-on-one with Jeff, get the questions answered that you need to have answered to put you on a path towards a confident retirement. Once again, it's the Retirement Review, sort of the retirement roadmap, if you will, 520-780-9059 or online at premret.com, P-R-E-M-R-E-T.com. Jeff, we've talked in the show so many times about people getting this retirement roadmap, and I thought I might take the next few minutes of our program here just to let people know what that is. It's actually a 5-point retirement review. Can you go into more detail about what those 5 points are?
Well, as we call them, the pillars of planning. You know, we use pillars in our imagery of our company a lot. It's, you know, what holds up the overall plan, right? The first pillar is, you know, protecting what you've worked a lifetime to achieve. What kind of investments are you going to make that protect principal and don't go down? How do you turn that investment philosophy, that new investment philosophy, because it's not usually the one most people are prescribing to prior to retirement. It's all about growth. It's all about dollar cost averaging into the market. And I think that's smart. But I think you need to consider, you know, how much can you afford to lose and not put money in the market that you might need for your bills at risk. So we want to focus on that. And the reason we want to focus on those investments and the protection of those investments is because much of that will likely be needed for income. So the next phase would be our income phase. You know, what income are you getting that's guaranteed right now? Social Security? How much Social Security? Did you get some sort of a pension offset or a windfall exemption or some sort of a thing that would, you know, maybe impede your ability to collect all of your Social Security? Or when should you take the Social Security? And once we've got that figured out, do you have pensions or other income guarantees that will help bridge the gap between what Social Security pays for and what you want to live on as far as your minimum, you know, nut, right? Your minimum lifestyle needs. Maybe you've got a million or a couple million dollars in IRAs and other funds that you want to try to not use until you're 73 or old enough to take required minimum distributions. You want to spend all your savings now. Well, in my opinion, that would be a mistake, because all you're doing is kicking the tax can down the road and probably going to force yourself into a higher tax bracket. So you'll pay more taxes on more money at a higher rate later rather than paying it now. So again, we look at the income. What's the most efficient way to use the savings that are going to be taxed? Do we need to convert some of that savings into tax-free money through Roth conversions or life insurance type programs? Or even an annuity that pays principal plus interest, so you know what your tax bracket is going to be for the next 5, 7, or 10 years. We can ladder those investments to create guaranteed income or predictable income, depending on if you want to take a little bit of risk, but we want to minimize the risk as much as possible. So, you know, looking at the investments, they have to correlate with that income plan. So there's the investment pillar. There's, you know, what's the allocation? How much risk can you afford? Are you taking too much risk? Do you need to dial it down? Do you need to create some asset classes that are more income generating, tax efficient, principal protected, even tax free? Or are we looking at this from a standpoint of, you know, passing on to heirs, which we'll get to in a minute? Okay, so then there's a tax plan, and I kind of integrated that. The first three really work together. You know, how do you invest? How do you create income? And how do you save the most amount in taxes? Do you want to pay taxes now on less money and get it out of the way and never pay tax again, which you might be able to do? Or would you rather pay taxes as you go for the rest of your life on an account that might continue to grow? Well, we can put that out on a spreadsheet and see what makes the most sense. It's kind of like a farmer who buys $100,000 worth of seed for his field. And the accountant quickly says, oh, you can write that off. It's $100,000. Well, what if there was a law? And by the way, in a year or two, you're going to end up with $1 million of crops to sell, all of which basically you can write off the $100,000. But then what? Then all the crop sales are gains and are taxable. What if you could say, you know what, I'll pay all the taxes on the grain, I'll plant my field and everything, but can I just sell it tax-free when I get the money? Sure, okay. Well, what if that was available to you in a retirement plan? Well, it is. It's called a Roth IRA. It's also called LIRP, Life Insurance Retirement Plan. You pay taxes now on that money at whatever the value is, but you don't pay taxes for the rest of your life at whatever bracket might come to be. And I don't think the tax brackets are going to go down over the next 30 or 40 years. I have a pretty good feeling they're going to go up, because politicians do math one day. It's income versus outgo. It's not about economic supply, demand, creating more taxes through accommodating tax practices, which Donald Trump did and actually showed the fact that they could raise more tax money by lowering tax rates. Why? Because people spend more, invest more, and because they're not sending it all to the government, they actually keep it in play in the economy for several steps before it ends up, you know, in Washington down the black hole. So we want to make sure that that investment, the income, and the tax plan is all, you know, meshing nicely together. So, you know, then the other two are really not after the fact, but they're important too. How do you take care of healthcare, those healthcare needs, like the long-term care issues? Do you self-insure? Do you buy some sort of a plan that covers that? And then how do you give what you have left to who you want, how you want, with least amount of trouble, taxes, and avoiding probate? That's the estate plan. We can do that through trust or just, you know, creative allocation and distributions through beneficiary assignment. So again, those are the five pillars of planning. If you don't have all of them in your plan, then I believe you're lacking. And unfortunately, too many companies in our business, too many advisors that should do better leave them all out. All they do is say, oh, I'm going to get a fee. I'll just take care of your stocks and bonds, do a 40-60 and, you know, pay me a fee and I'll go golfing every day and we'll check up every year. Well, that's not a plan. That's just that's a portfolio manager. It's not given any value for what they're supplying, in my opinion. So we like the full comprehensive plan. We like taking care of all the pillars of your plan. And we like making sure that you sail off into that retirement sunset, you know, knowing that you're safe and that you're going to be okay.
So once again, that's our 5-point retirement review that's in our retirement roadmap. And the number to get yours, 520-780-9059, 520-780-9059. Hey, Jeff, we're out of time for this week. I want to thank you for your time, but most of all, I want to thank our listeners for joining us here in the greater Tucson area. For Jeff Hogan, I'm Jeff Shade. Have a great weekend, won't you? We'll talk to you again next week with another edition of Premier Retirement right here on 790 KNST, Tucson's most stimulating talk.
Investment advisory services provided through Premier Wealth Advisors, LLC, an Arizona State Registered Investment Advisor. Securities transactions are placed through TD Ameritrade. Insurance and annuity products are offered through Premier Advantage, Inc., DBA Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any reference to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims paying abilities of the insurance carrier. The show is intended for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as advice or recommendations. Due to show format, accuracy, and completeness cannot be guaranteed. Premier Retirement and its representatives do not provide legal or tax advice and may only conduct business with residents of states and jurisdictions where they're properly registered.
Hi, this is Jeff Vogan, founder and CEO of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. We're in the financial planning business so you can be in the let's have fun and not worry about your retirement business. It makes no difference to us whether you want to hang out with the grandkids, go back to school, start a new career or hobby, or spend your retirement partying in the Caribbean. These are your choices. Our mission is to help you protect your life's work and turn it into a predictable income plan to finance the things that make you happy. Premier's investment philosophy is simple. Protect and manage your savings. Create strategies that seek not only to provide an income stream you can count on, but to grow your principal to keep up with your lifestyle. Retirement, the way you want it. Finding the right partner that really understands you and your goals could truly shape your life for the next 30 years or more. So call us at Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management for a complimentary, no-obligation financial review at 520-780-9059. That's 520-780-9059. Or visit us online at premret.com. That's premret.com.
Investment advisory services offered through Premier Wealth Advisors, LLC, an Arizona State Registered Investment Advisor.